I'm glad to be here. My name is Larry Rafman. I teach at Johns Hopkins at the Homewood campus. My interests are interdisciplinary, and I'm stationed in the psychology department, psychology and brain sciences. But my focus really is on the interface between psychology and other disciplines. In particular, I'm interested in psychology and economics, known as behavioral finance, actually.
Very good. Welcome. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, and we're doing this month's Great Ideas. So the interface between psychology and economics. Certainly there's lots of psychology going on right now in terms of economics, isn't there?
No question. The markets in many people's eyes are almost 90% psychology and confidence and attitude. People either love or they hate stocks, depending on the circumstances and the environment that they're in. No question.
So tell me some more about that. Certainly, we're all looking at the stock market right now, worrying about our retirement assets, I'm sure, some of us anyway. What does psychology have to do with that?
Psychology takes a different perspective than you might find in classical finance or classical economics, which really looks to optimize success or making decisions in an optimal framework. Psychology takes a different perspective. It looks really at how people actually do make decisions, not what would be idyllic, but actually how people do, describing actually how it happens. As a result of that effort and research, we're looking at a descriptive profile of decision making. In light of that, the behavioral finance or behavioral economics perspective has come to the conclusion that people worry dramatically about their gains and losses rather than worrying about their absolute returns. Let me tell you what I mean. For example, if my brother is worth $10 million and his account goes down by $1 million, he's going to be concerned $1 million. But if my account goes down by $10,000, but my account's worth a lot less, my losses will mean a lot to me. And his losses should not really mean that much to him. However, people do suffer losses much more horribly than gains. It's a psychological reality. They're not able to be objective about losses. And so, as you say, right now, people are going through a lot of pain. Even successful people that can tolerate these situations are going through a lot of pain.
And so the fact that they're going through a lot of pain, how does that inform their decision making?
They become much more risk averse. They become more fearful about keeping their portfolio or their assets in the same vision or perspective as they had been historically. And they start to pull in and get fearful about losses, further losses, because losses upon losses become intolerable. And when that happens, everything starts to shut down. And that's why we've heard a lot of references to the Depression era times when Roosevelt said, what you have to fear is fear itself. Once again, the markets will eventually go through this and get over, but people are right now in a state of fear and anxiety.
Would you say that this state of fear and anxiety on the part of people you've already described as successful people, people with adequate assets for themselves, or perhaps on the part of their companies, may actually fuel the recession further?
Yes, because we need those people, successful people, to be leaders and step up and make the investments and take the risks and not let the fear hamstring them in such a way as to shut down. Unfortunately, when you look at news items where fraud and scandal occupy people's minds, it brings to bear so much more fear and anxiety, the opposite of, in fact, what we need. People overweight in the larger aggregate picture these incidents that unfortunately play too big a role in shutting down people and causing people to postpone decisions. We're in a scenario where we're worried about deflation, where prices going down, which would seem like a good thing, but the reality is the fear is so badly gripped that people don't plan for the future and make allocations and make inventory grow that cause the prices to drop because no one's willing to buy. So the prices have to chase the lack of buyers. It's gripped the market mentality.
Sounds like then this is something that is apparent on the part of the individual investor as well as a more corporate attitude.
Yes, it's really influenced and impacted all ranges, all levels, and all effects. What's interesting, too, in another way, the psychology of investment decisions, when you look at how people actually make decisions, they use shortcuts. They use what's called heuristics or mental shortcuts to allow themselves to overweight events in ways that don't reflect the actual objective reality. So if you take the objective reality as defined by base rates, probabilities, people ignore or sidestep that in favor of overweighting what is the fad of the moment or what is the thing that's grabbed their attention so dramatically. These heuristics undermine the ability to make rational or appropriate decisions. And this is another contribution for psychology over here in the world of finance.
What do we do then? Here we are, we're gripped in this period of fear and anxiety. All of this is kind of going in a downward spiral. So what kind of objective evidence is there that people ought to be looking at that would help to reverse that or at least stabilize
it? Do you know what? The part of the problem is people are looking too much and too closely. If people would turn off their TVs and not look at CNBC every day and not watch the dire news as it comes across every day, but choose to periodically check in with their reality and not overweight the present, but keep perspective in looking out to the future as well as the present, that might help discipline them to think more rationally and not reactively in dealing with the markets.
Is there any historical data that helps to support the idea that, in fact, the market will come back?
The market always has come back. The market will come back through this time. The problem is, simply put, how much pain and how quickly do we endure the pain as the market comes back? 10 years ago, I was involved in a horrible car accident. Medical doctors offered me OxyContin as a way to deal with my pain because I was suffering a lot of bone pain. And I was faced with the dilemma of being fearful of becoming addicted to that pain medication into the future by easing my pain in the present. There's a war going on between the pundits that argue we should take our pain, go through this, and like a Band-Aid getting ripped off us, get through this as efficiently, quickly as possible, endure the pain and move on. The other side has argued we have to protect ourselves from the worst of this and not unnecessarily burden ourselves with unnecessary pain, even if it might take a little bit longer to pass through. We always do get through, and there will be a time where we'll look back on this in the future.
I find this rather interesting that you've identified these two camps, the one that says quick and dirty, let's get this over with, let's just take our pain, and the other one that wants to prolong it. But do either of these camps really have the power to determine how long this is going to last? Anyway,
not really, because no one really controls the market. That's what's both exciting and beautiful about it, because it's an aggregate beyond any individual's control, no matter how powerful, but also because it does have its own life. So you're right. People ultimately are deluding themselves to think they're in a position to run the market in the direction we want. Markets are wise, ultimately wise. And the argument has often been, should they be left alone or should they be meddled with? The truth be told, there neither one is the answer. It's a combination of both.
And would you agree with the assertion then that increasingly we're almost becoming a single market world? With
yes.
Globalization, we all kind of have a hand in this. So then I would ask you to reflect on how the psychology of different cultures may play into this global market.
Yes. And the attitudes of investing and the attitudes toward risk and the attitudes about when to be more risk-free and risk averse and risk-seeking, being risk-seeking, taking on challenges, not to think entirely in terms of purely optimal economic models, but to think in terms of cultures and attitudes towards spending and saving.
So I would ask you then to do two things. In the short term, give the individual investor advice on how to deal with the psychology as it interacts with the market. And the second one is, if you were sitting right here right now with President-elect Obama, what would you say in terms of interventions, government roles?
Wow, that's a tall order you've set up here. What I would say to the individual investor is to not get in your own way. Allow yourself to keep your perspective. Now, with regard to Obama, everyone in the media and beyond has been truly wowed by the success of our new president-elect to put together a team that represents competence and capacity. I think he's on the right track when it comes to enhancing our sense of confidence.
So in general, you sound extremely optimistic.
I'm hopeful because I think that this country is leading the world out from this crisis. We are in that role and we will come through. So, yes, I am optimistic in that regard.
Thank you so very, very much for joining me and for giving me such a positive outlook.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.